Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Imagine leaving home and traveling by yourself to a new land where you don't know the customs or the politics, on a trip that will take 3 weeks to complete in what would now be considered a very small ship on turbulent waters. Imagine making this voyage never to return to your homeland when you're 15 years old and pregnant. Soon after you arrive, a war begins that changes the face of the country and sets a new type of government in motion. Imagine researching this story and then writing it. That's the work of Patrick McGrath, the author of Martha Peak, a book about a plucky young woman who came to America in 1774. I spoke with Patrick McGrath by phone in 2001 to talk about Martha Peak, how he researched and prepared to write it, and what British students are taught about the American Revolution. We began when I asked Patrick McGrath to tell us about Martha Peak.
Martha Peak is a young woman who falls foul of her father, Harry Peak, in 18th century London. Her father takes to drink, and although their bond is very close and very loving, his character, his very nature, begins to change, and she's forced to flee to America. And the year is 1774, and the revolution is about to break out.
How old is Martha at that time?
Martha is 15 years old. She's a red-haired, spirited, courageous girl, and has been forced to run away from the father she adores.
Where does she come from in your experience?
In my own experience, I don't know that I can pin her down. She emerged pretty much full-blown from my imagination as a sort of an ideal of a gutsy, plucky, feisty young woman who would respond well to the various adventures and trials and tribulations that I was planning to put her through in this book.
How can you create the pluck of a 15-year-old girl who lived 230 years ago?
Well, the first thing is to get the background credible and plausible, and that involves research, enough research so that one feels comfortable in the imagination, with the way that, the rooms looked and felt and smelt, the streets, what people wore, what they ate. And once you can bring the period alive in your own mind, it then becomes possible to sort of set a character moving against that backdrop, how Martha, for example, is going to react to any given situation that arises, what her daily routine is going to look like, how she talks.
Tell us about how you conduct your investigation to create these historical images and historical truths.
As I read about the period, histories come to hand, and I'm not a great user of libraries. I tend to go to bookstores and second-hand bookstores. As I read, I tend to pick out details of the daily life of the period, and if they have a certain sort of vividness, if they seem to have a lot of resonance in terms of giving a sense of the character of the time, then I'll make a note of them. And use them as I'm building scenes, as I'm writing descriptive passages. And by means of an accumulation of details in the first instance I've found in my research, and in the second instance that I've imaginatively extrapolated from my reading, I can begin to put together, enough details of a particular place that it feels adequate to me, and then, as I say, I can put my characters into that setting and get them moving.
Perhaps you could read a portion of the book for us that could put us into the setting that you describe.
Well, why don't I read a couple of paragraphs right from the beginning of the book, where my narrator, a young man called Ambrose Tree, has gone out across a marsh south of London and to visit his old uncle, and there he sees a picture hanging on the wall, and it's that picture intrigues him, and his intrigue causes him to ask his uncle a question, and the answer to that question sets the story in motion. So let me read those couple of paragraphs for you. I found the old doctor seated close to a blazing coal fire in a small gloomy room with a heavy Turkey carpet on the floor and thick dark curtains on the windows. He had a blanket on his knees, a tome in his lap, and a jorum of Hollands and water close to hand. As he turned toward the door, I saw at once that he could not belong for this world, so frail did he appear, his skin in the firelight as white and brittle as paper. But on recognizing me, a light came up in those dim and milky eyes. He fixed me with a gimlet stare and cried to me to come in. Come in, for the love of God, for the draught was a chill one. And he pointed with a trembling finger to the aged leather armchair on the other side of the fireplace. But still I stood there in the open door, rooted to the spot. I was transfixed by the painting hanging over the mantelpiece. I had never seen it before. It was the portrait of a robust, broad-shouldered man of between 30 and 40 years. He stood against a wild moorland scene, a pine flattening in the gale on the brow of a distant hill, and rags of black cloud flying across the sky. He wore neither hat nor wig, and his long hair was tied at the back with a blue ribbon, a few strands torn free by the wind. His shirt was open at the throat, his skin was pale, and his eyes were like great dark pools, full of life and full of pain, but hooded somehow, lost in shadow, as they gazed off into some unknown horizon. It was not a handsome face. It was carved too rough for that, but it was a strong, complicated face, hatched and knotted with sorrow and passion, a big, stubborn chin uplifted, the whole head uplifted, lips unsmiling and slightly parted, and the expression one of defiance, yes, and purpose. I felt at once that the artist, for all that he had caught some fleeting expression of this fierce romantic spirit, could not have done him justice. Nobody could have done justice to this man. My Uncle William nodded at me with a pursed smile as I closed the door behind me and moved to the chair by the fire, my gaze still fixed on the painting, and slowly sat down. "You know who he is, eh?" said my uncle. "No, sir," I said. "I do not." "No? Then shall I tell you?" It was Harry Peake.
Harry Peake was Martha's father.
That's right.
What kind of a person was he? You tell us in the passage that you read about how he was first seen, brought into the book.
This is how he's first seen, and as the story begins, we find Harry as a young man living in Cornwall, in the west of England, in the 1760s. He's a smuggler. He is a big, strong, well-liked, active, competent man, a leader among men, really. He has a natural gift for poetry, but he has a weakness for the drink. And in those first pages, we see him very much the master of his environment, which is the rough, craggy headlands and cliffs of Cornwall, where he works basically as a smuggler and a fisherman. But we'll soon see his fortunes change when, in his drunkenness one night, he manages to burn down the family home, a fire in which his wife dies and in which he is badly injured by a falling beam that grossly deforms his spine.
Is that kind of event, in your knowledge, common? Did that happen often?
Well, I don't know that it happened often, but this book is It's a romantic book. It's a big, sweeping, and rather melodramatic sort of a novel. That's what I set out to write here. So everything is heightened somewhat. Whereas this is it's quite simply a rather melodramatic event.
That's an understatement.
It's an understatement, I know. What I wanted to do was give Harry Peake some reason to be in some way sort of monstrous, in some way deformed. This was important to my scheme of the novel. And this is the way I chose to do it. I could have done it in quieter ways, in more naturalistic ways. But the theme of fire was important in this book, and also the theme of alcohol. And this was a way of putting together all those themes that will recur again and again throughout the book in different forms.
I want to take a moment and say that this week we're talking with Patrick McGrath, the author of a new book called Martha Peake, about a 15-year-old young woman in 1774 who flees England and comes to Boston. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Patrick, when you choose the themes and weave them together, is there a particular message, an underlying message perhaps, that you seek to convey?
There is. It develops in the writing of the book. I don't sort of come to the writing of a book with a message very clearly articulated in my mind. With this one, I knew I wanted to write a historical novel, and I wanted to address the question of how reliable is the history we learn and the historical images that we have of the past, particularly something as important and vivid in the American imagination as the Revolution. And I wanted to explore the extent to which history, in terms of the actual events of that time, become transformed through the generations into something more closely approaching myth. And I wanted, if I could, to chart that movement where actual events, which are complicated and not simple to understand in any sort of straightforward way, how those do become simplified over time, so that what we get in the end is a set of legends, really, a set of myths, rather than the full complexity of human motives and difficult and complicated circumstances that is probably the real situation in any given sort of incident in real life.
What sort of myths do you feel you've been able to identify in putting this book together?
Well, I think the basic myth of the Revolution, as I understand it, and I'm not an American, of course, though I've lived here for many years.
But that does give you an interesting perspective, having grown up in England.
Well, it does, and so I have perhaps been more deeply immersed in the myths of English history. Coming to this country, what I found was a story of a people that was not really very well organized in military terms, but who had a passionate sense of their own rights and of the injustice being done by a tyrannical government, or a tyrannical king, I should say, far over the seas, who was denying them their basic natural rights.
What did you learn as a person growing up in England about the American Revolution, or did you call it the American Secession?
No, it wasn't called the American Secession. It was called the War of American Independence, and it was called the American Revolution. And this is one of the interesting aspects of history that I wanted to explore in the novel is that growing up in England, I would have a very different picture of it, obviously, from somebody like yourself growing up in America.
Right. And just a moment ago, you characterized the king as being a tyrant.
Well, from the American point of view...
But how about from the British point of view?
From the British point of view, King George III sort of oversaw a major sort of expansion of British power overseas. He also went mad, we know that, but we find that rather quaint and interesting. But in the sort of in the history of Great Britain, this period, the late 18th century, would see us beginning to develop major trade networks, our military power growing, our naval power growing, the threat of Napoleon beginning to emerge, and of course we go into the great years of the struggles with Napoleon, which culminate in the great British victory at the Battle of Waterloo. And I think it's the American story is something of a sidebar to this, a rather embarrassing event in which we managed through some clumsiness to lose some rather important colonies. But this certainly wouldn't be central to our picture of Britain in that period. Whereas, of course, if you grew up in the United States, this is the seminal event. This is the birth of the Republic. And instead of seeing Britain as a great nation getting ever greater year by year, it seems that the British are a people under the thumb of a tyrannical king who had a very short shrift with the colonies in terms of what their natural rights were, what their political and economic rights were, and would take no sort of defiance. And when the colonies attempted to establish more control over their own affairs, the British responded with a series of rather punitive laws, and eventually with a military occupation of Boston.
I'm curious about your characterization of, I think the way you put it, England and Britain proceeded with some clumsiness. What do you mean? Is that your interpretation now, or is that the way it is taught in the history books and in the history lessons?
I don't know how it's taught in this country, but in the reading of my of the history that I found in my research for this book, the British failed to realize, it seems, certainly the British government failed to realize just how important economic expansion was to the Americans, and also how much they treasured the rights of self-government that had been established in the colonies, particularly Massachusetts, in the 150 years that the colonies had been in existence. And they trampled roughshod over those rights by imposing taxes from London without any consultation with the colonies, and failed to understand that the colonies or many of the colonists would be outraged at these sort of rather arbitrary edicts emerging from London that basically took away from them the right to govern and tax themselves that they'd grown used to. And the British were clumsy in not recognizing that they'd made a false move here, and instead they gradually exacerbated the problem in an effort to impose their own control over the colonies, and simply aggravated and frustrated the colonists to the point where what had been, a very loyal part of the British Empire was totally disaffected, totally alienated, and prepared to go to war with the mother country. And even as early as sort of 1773, 1774, most American colonists thought of themselves as Englishmen, and for them it was completely unthinkable that they should not be a part of the British Empire.
Do you think
and the government, I think, you know, undid all of that goodwill, forfeited it.
Do you think that there could have been a different tact or form of behavior on the part of Britain at that time that would not have resulted in the revolution in America?
Oh, I think so. I think they...
What would that have been?
I think they could have been far more conciliatory and have recognized the strength of feeling in the colonies as regards their own customs of self-government.
Why was Britain blind to the feelings in America?
Yeah, they were blind, and they were also rather condescending and dismissive.
But why?
They thought of the colonists as second-class citizens, really. They thought them rough, unsophisticated people whose opinions didn't really matter to sort of, you know, aristocratic government ministers in London.
So would that have been applicable to any other part of the British Empire? That kind of same attitude of superiority, if you will, on the part of the aristocracy?
I think this had been true sort of up to that point, and it was true, I think, in their government of the of their Caribbean colonies, Jamaica, Barbados. I think that after the revolution, in combination with other factors, the British basically treated their colonies somewhat differently, and they didn't tend to make the same mistake again.
Patrick, I'd like to ask you more about Martha Peake, but first I want to remind our listeners that this week we're talking with Patrick McGrath, the author of a new and very intriguing book called Martha Peake, the story of a 15-year-old young woman who left England in 1774 under some rather odd circumstances that the book details, and comes to America. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Patrick, the book is told by Ambrose, the narrator. Tell us about Ambrose and the role that you are trying to place on him as the narrator.
Well, Ambrose is a young man who, as I described him coming out to his uncle's house, who begins to hear the story of Harry Peake. He's a young, impressionable, rather hot-tempered, rather romantic fellow of about 25. And as he begins to hear the story of Harry Peake and his daughter Martha and what Martha encounters in America, he jumps to the conclusion that a terrible wrong is being done to certain of the characters in this story, and particularly to the American colonies. He's very much on the side of the colonists in their revolutionary struggle, and this is part of his very sort of hot-headed, immediate sort of knee-jerk sympathy for the underdog. So he sees the story in the light of these passions of his own, these biases of his own, and he spends the almost the entirety of the book arguing with his old uncle as to how the events that are described should be interpreted. And his uncle, being older, wiser, more cranky, is far more cynical about human nature and about history. He's far more conservative, as tends to be the case with old men. And so what I've tried to set up is a dialogue, or more than a dialogue, an argument about how Martha Peake's history, and on a larger scale, how the history of the American Revolution is to be seen, and where the truth lies, with Ambrose taking a very strong liberal Republican revolutionary line with great fervor, and his old uncle being far more cautious and far more wary of revolutionary movements and upheaval and bloodshed. And and so I wanted to set up a sort of really a dialogue between youth and age on this particular historical topic.
Patrick McGrath, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like you to tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Well, as you can imagine, my thoughts have been very much tied up with the American Revolution recently, and I've just come upon a book which I've not finished yet, but I'm enjoying enormously. It's called The First American, and it's The Life and Times of Benjamin Franklin by a historian called H.W. Brands. It's published by Doubleday, and it's the best sort of narrative history, and I'm just having a great time of it. It's well written, it moves at a great pace, and gives you a very good sense of one of the most fascinating and complex and able of the men of that period, and a man, of course, who played such a huge and vital role in the American Revolution.
Patrick McGrath, thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
My great pleasure.
Patrick McGrath is the author of Martha Peak. He's also the author of Asylum, a book about his youth growing up, the son of a psychiatrist, next to where violent and psychotic criminals were incarcerated in England. The book he recommends is The First American by H.W. Brown. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.